Consumerism is our topic today, and we need a little bit of a run-up to this, so we're going to begin with a crowd scene. Does anybody know where that picture was taken? Port Talbot. That's right. Why? What was the occasion? The Passion, that's right, which I think is more than 10 years. Is that Michael Sheen at the front there? Thank you. I forgot his name. Thanks, Pete, but you're the sort of guy who would remember that crucial detail. And they organised this fantastic Passion thing, and they had crowds of up to, I think they had 25,000 people through. There's not 25,000 people in there, but there's a big crowd. And that's where we're going to go, because in Luke chapter 12, verse 1 sets the scene. Meanwhile, when a crowd of many thousands had gathered, so that they were trampling on one another. There's a note I hadn't seen before. Jesus began to speak first to his disciples, saying, "Be on your guard against the yeast of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy." It was heaving. And Jesus begins to teach. And he covers a lot of ground in, obviously, what we have is a snapshot of his teaching. But he ends on a prophetic word, talking about the fate of Christians after the crucifixion and resurrection, the fate of Christians in the future. And they're going to have a tough time. He says, "When you are brought before the synagogues, the rulers and authorities," in other words, when you go on trial, "do not worry about how you will defend yourselves." They'll be on trial for being Christians. "Or what you will say, for the Holy Spirit will teach you at that time what you should say." Christians will be forced to make a defense of their faith. They will be questioned about following Jesus. The stakes are high. Some people will pay with their lives. "But do not be anxious," Jesus teaches, "because the Holy Spirit will uplift you in the moment of trial." Literally, of course, a trial. Now, I think we would agree that that's enough to give us a moment's pause. And I think that's what happened. People start processing that. Oh, it's not all going to be wine and roses and a fantastic time. You know, the Christian life might be tough. And in that pause, in that moment of quiet, some guy, and there's always one, some guy grabs the opportunity to have his say. "Jesus, tell my brother to give me my money." Really? Really? We're just talking about the suffering of Christians? What's this guy thinking about? His money. Jesus is teaching about the cost of following him, the price of being a disciple. Has this guy not been listening? He's come to say that, hasn't he? He's come with his prepared line. "Give me the money." Easy to mock him, of course, and I am. But I suspect we've all been there or thereabouts. People come to Jesus, people come to church for all sorts of reasons. Personal gain is sometimes one of them. Thousands came to Jesus to be healed, but had no interest in sticking around afterwards. I had a lovely conversation with a minister in Cardiff, and somebody came to him. So he was put in touch with a lady who was suffering from cancer, and she wasn't a Christian. And he said, "Would you like me to pray?" She had a very bad diagnosis and the medication wasn't working. "Would you like me to pray with you and for you?" And she said, "Yes." And so he prayed with her over the next few weeks of her treatment. And she was healed. And he said to her, "You know who healed you, don't you? That was Jesus." And she said, "Yeah, but I'm not interested." Interesting, really, isn't it? Interesting. But asking Jesus wasn't totally left field, because all law in Israel is religious law. And so it's understandable that someone might turn to Jesus for help with the law. You know, the teachers of the law is a common phrase in the gospel. And he's known for having time for people, isn't he? For spending time with the poor, for helping people. So it's kind of logical. Who better to get on your side in a dispute where you might be the injured party. We don't know, do we? But surely Jesus will help me. I'm on the right side of the dispute about money. Have you ever noticed that in a dispute about money, you're always on the, I'm always on the right side of a dispute about money? Yeah? And Jesus replied, "Man, who made me a judge or an arbiter or a divider?" It is literally dividing the inheritance between you. Who made me the boss of you? I've never seen you before. You're not a disciple. You've just rocked up today. And then he said to them, he adds a warning, "Watch out, be on your guard against all kinds of greed." So the story starts with being about money, give me my inheritance, and it goes on to greed, and it ends up in possessions, which of course is where consumerism lives. Life does not consist in an abundance of possessions. Amen? Or not? Life does not consist in the abundance of possessions. And I speak there as a man who has too many possessions. Just ask my wife. She'll give you a long, long, long list. And if you want, and if you hear that I'm dead, get round to my house, right? Because if you want old broadcasting gear that's utterly useless, now you'll be able to get loads of it. Yeah? So what, according to Jesus, does our life consist of if it does not consist of possessions? And secondly, why is the power and the pull of money and possessions so irresistible? Let's take the second of those questions first. Why is consumerism so successful? When Barclays, I think, launched the first credit card in the UK, I think in the 1960s, their slogan was "Right on the money," if you excuse the pun. Does anybody know what it was? "Take the waiting out of wanting." I don't know how much they paid whoever came up with that, but it was worth every penny. Take the wait. They didn't mention the high interest rates and the crippling debt and all that stuff, right? "Take the waiting out of wanting." What inspired marketing? Because we are all naturally wanters, are we not? Yeah? And it's entirely understandable. We want somewhere to live. Yeah, that's necessary. We want clothes to wear and something to eat. Yes. But wanting shades from the necessities of life right across to the nice to haves. A bigger TV, a better holiday, Japanese screwdrivers. Now you all want them, don't you? If you've got a man in your life, get him some of these, right? Well, actually anybody could have those. Lovely Japanese screwdrivers, right? There we go. Sorry about that. It's just shoes. I don't care about shoes. But shoes, some people care about shoes, don't they? Our economy, our whole economy, is driven by our compulsion to consume. Yeah? That's kind of how it works. My desire for Japanese screwdrivers keeps the Japanese screwdriver economy going, doesn't it? And the factories and the workers, all the way over in the Japan, the people who ship it all over here, and the people who sell it in the shop. Yeah? Our engines of production are working. Well, they're not our engines of production anymore, are they? They're mostly in China and in Vietnam and all over the world. But they're all out there making that stuff so that we can have it. And we don't necessarily need, I don't need Japanese, I mean, I love Japanese screwdrivers. I've got plenty of screwdrivers. I should have brought all my screwdrivers today, shouldn't I? Really, I don't need any more. But I do love a screwdriver. That's the dilemma. And we have stuff we don't need, and we're very happy to throw. In fact, yeah, if you want any of my old screwdrivers, come and see me. Because what we do is we go, "Oh, we'll get rid of that. Don't need that, and then I'll have a new one, a shinier one." And all of our wanting is driven by an all-pervasive advertising culture that is embedded into every TV, phone, PC, parking meter. I went to park in Cardiff Town Centre on Thursday, and as I was putting my card into the machine, there's a screen advertising new cars. I thought, I'll just leave the old one here, go round to the new car shop and drive away in something new when you're buying the ticket. It's incredible, isn't it? We haven't just taken the waiting out of wanting either. We've taken the walking out of wanting. eBay. Oh, I love eBay. Right? Am I alone here? No. Amazon, how about that? No. I don't believe you. Amazon's great. You know, you press the button today and tomorrow there's somebody with a parcel at your door. How cool is that? I don't even walk, right? But if I do walk, if I go to the supermarkets, I used to go to the village shop in Tarskovig, long since finished, and it had a counter. And there was a rather grumpy old man behind the counter, and all the things in the shop were on a shelf behind him, except for the things that were under the counter. You had to ask for the thing. Well, of course, Asda's realised that's not the way to sell things to Alistair. The way to sell things to Alistair is to put them on a big aisle, isn't it? Where he can put, oh, I think I do need some kidney beans. Actually, no. I think I do need whatever it is. You know, they don't have nice screwdrivers in Asda, but whatever it is. And my son mocks me for my impulse buying, you know? Do you do that in a supermarket? You go in for one thing, you come out with a basket. And these days, that is an expensive option. Wanting, naturally, under those conditions, goes wild. Are you a bargain hunter? Do you spend your time on reviews? I had a friend of mine, he was getting a company car. He had a spreadsheet about this wide of all the cars and all their features, you know, how many miles to the gallon, how many Bluetooth connect, I don't know, all the things that you get in a modern car. And that and his wife was mocking him, you know. Why don't we just pick the one we like? Why don't we just pick the one with the best color, you know? But that really appeals to our hunting instinct. Now, John Wesley, great, great man of God, once gave this financial advice to Christians, and I can't think of better. Number one, and rather surprisingly, but number one, earn all you can. Interesting. Work hard, in other words. Save, this is the one we find difficult, or the second most difficult, save all you can. The third one? Give all you can. I don't think there's any of us here who could say that without feeling a little bit uncomfortable, or maybe a lot, yeah? Earn all you can, save all you can, give all you can. Our consumer society is driven by us spending all we can. And Wesley missed out spend all we can for a very good reason. So we can save it and so we can give it. And there's so many ways to spend our money, isn't there? Not just a mortgage. We can borrow for car loans, for leasing, and flexible finance, store cards. Are store cards still a thing? At one time they went crazy, didn't they? Every week a store card would come through. I don't think it's so much, but store cards. Payday loans, the weekly shopping on the credit card. You know, not counting our mortgages or our car loans, on average, a British adult owes £4,000 each. The average household has £2,376 of credit card debt. Now, Wesley noticed something very interesting in his travels. He preached to the working class, he preached to the poor, the drunk, the broken. And when people turned to faith, things started to change. Whole communities became Christians under his preaching. And what happened then was people started working hard. And people stopped drinking. And they stopped gambling. And they stopped beating their wives. And the whole community began to improve. It's a phenomenon known as lift. The positive impact of the Christian faith and ethics on life in general. At the heart of that is a new attitude to money. Once we've earned it and saved it, Christians should be looking around for opportunities to give it. And here, a Christian understanding parts company with the world of bean counting economics, or indeed glossy consumer dreams of stuff unlimited. But if Christian life is not about piling up the stuff, what it is about? Well, Jesus said, seek first, what are we to seek? His kingdom. Seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. If there's a harder word in the Bible, I don't know. I don't know it. Maybe Paul's version. I might have a slide. Have I got a slide? Yeah. Paul's version is lovely, isn't it? I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to God, offering to God ourselves a life of sacrifice. It's a peculiar choice, really, that we're offered when you think about it. On the one side, and this is true in a way today that it wasn't true in the time of Jesus, everything that you can imagine. Yeah? Cars, phones, holidays, stylish fashion, as you see being modeled here by me. Yeah? Jewelry. That's ridiculous jewelry, isn't it? I don't see anybody wearing that. Anyway, there we go. Speakers. Oh, I love speakers. Yeah, maybe, you know, they go with screwdrivers in a strange way. Shoes, training shoes there. Somebody was talking about kids being killed for their training shoes. Jordan Airs, what crazy world we live in. Bicycles and all manners of road transport. TVs, that's a massive Samsung TVs. Fine food, you can spend a lot of money on fine food. Lovely furniture, yes. Books, paintings, art. Rugs. Like I give up here. 9 new trends in rugs. I found on the internet. 9 new trends. What are we doing? Smoking them, right? You put the rug on the floor. I don't know what else you're going to do with a rug, okay? But I haven't finished, have I? There's loads of stuff. There's sports kit and coffee machines and hoovers and appliances and kitchenware and miter saws and everything. That's on one side. And we now understand that the business of buying those things, whether it's that obsessive hunting for the best goods and prices, you know, it's somehow therapeutic. You know, we talk about retail. It makes us, the act of buying things makes us feel better. There's a million videos on YouTube, unwrapping videos. People unwrapping things. Who thought we'd be watching that? Somebody unwrapping, that's nice. I love unwrapping things, don't get me wrong. When those screwdrivers arrive at McGee Towers, I get huge, huge pleasure from unwrapping them. But like most therapies, it doesn't work. It doesn't last. We need another hit, don't we? And the truth is that most of the advertising is actually advertised. Not the very rarely do they advertise the product, do they? Does anybody know that lady? Sorry, the coffee, the gold, the famous gold blend adverts. Famous if you're my age. I can see the young people looking at it going, "Who is she?" Well, let me tell you, this very attractive lady and this very handsome man live opposite each other in a block of flats, I assume, or they're next door neighbours. And the whole point of the adverts is he pops round to borrow some coffee, or she pops, I can't remember which, probably he went round to buy some coffee, and romance blossoms, right? I've had gold blend coffee all my life, and an attractive lady next door has never come to the door, ringing them. They're not selling us coffee. They're selling us a better, buy this coffee and you will have a better life. On the other hand, and for goodness sake, let's remember the other hand. We got a bit lost in all the coffee and the lovely consumerism. Following Jesus and building a righteous life. And these things are not actually exclusive. I'm not saying follow Jesus and you don't get any coffee, right? I'm saying put him first. Be rich first to God. And we're asked to be rich to God. We're asked to be rich to Jesus. And Jesus became poor. How poor was Jesus? Can you think of a single time in the Gospels that Jesus has any money? He paid his tax with a miraculous coin from the mouth of a fish. I don't think he ever has a coin in the whole of his life. That was his poverty. And so we should be rich in response. The incident with the man in the crowd leads to Jesus telling this parable. And he told them this parable: the ground of a certain rich man yielded an abundant harvest. And he thought to himself, what shall I do? I've no place to store all my crops. Then he said, this is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones. And there I'll store my surplus grain, and I'll say to myself, you have plenty of grain laid up for many years. Take life easy, eat, drink, and be merry. Here's a man doing some serious financial planning. I don't know if you're a financial planning person. We're encouraged to do it, aren't we? And rightly so, probably. Look into the future, make some proper arrangements, and then enjoy a little self-satisfaction at a job well done, or maybe a bit of worry about, have I done enough? This is the sort of guy you might see on an advert for pensions. You know those tremendously happy older people that look not like me at all, right? But they're there, smiling, in there, usually with a cardigan on, sitting on a big comfy chair, looking out on a lawn, saying, yes, I invested my money with bigger barns, and now I've got a life of ease. Ring bigger barns now and claim your free. He's a totally modern man, this guy. What could possibly go wrong? Eh? What could possibly go wrong with our plans? But God said to him, you fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? This is how it will be with whoever stores up things for themselves, but is not rich towards God. Making plans without God is never a good idea. No good calling bigger barns now. They can't help you, can they? You can be as rich as you like, but none of us runs the universe. And we take so much for granted. Now, I want to be clear, this man is not a fool for being rich, though I think wealth does encourage us to think independently of God. We feel that we are sufficient in our resources. And the point of this story is, nobody is sufficient in their resources. But we can pinpoint his foolishness exactly with some help from John Wesley. Earn all you can, yes. Save all you can, yes, he needs bigger barns. Give all you can. Fail. A spectacular failure. And here's a picture of an icon of the rich fool. I think the jars there represent his money. In the background, the guys are building the barns. But he won't need them, because the angel is delivering God's message. The interesting thing about the parable is actually how alone this man is in his wealth. I think this is a better picture, isn't it? There's no friends mentioned, no family, not even a manager or people working for him. His only conversation is with himself. I'll build bigger barns. And what a rosy future he told himself that he had. Taking it easy. I'm going to work hard, and I'm going to take it easy and eat, drink, and be merry. That is the modern dream, is it not? I want to retire at 50. I want to retire at 40. A bit late for me now. Right. But maybe you're still on course for that. And I want to be comfortable then and enjoy. Work hard. Retire early. Live the good life. Does our world have anything else to offer? Actually, the man in the crowd, remember, the funny thing about this story is it's a callback to the man in the crowd. What was the man in the crowd concerned about? His inheritance. What's this guy concerned about? His inheritance. Except he's going to enjoy none of it. God says to him, who'll get what you so carefully prepared for yourself? Boom. So what are the learning points? The temptations of riches lies in the selfish nature of possession. This guy surveys his possessions and says, life is good. His life is limited to the view of his possessions. And I'm naturally tempted, as I'm sure we all are, to look to them for security and pleasure and reassurance, for some sort of guarantee in the future. And this man's guarantee proved to be empty. We can't make plans as if there are no surprises, as if God has no say. A couple of bewares very quickly. Beware seeing the consumer spec in somebody else's eye. I was having my breakfast at the BBC. I don't really have time for the story, but I'm going to tell it anyway. It's a great story. And I listened to two of my pals arguing. One of them had just bought some fantastic speakers. Massive speakers, right? I don't know. I think they cost 1,500 quid. And that was in 1987. So that would be about £3 million now. I don't know. And the other guy, I don't know his name. So they were arguing anyway. And the other guy says, that's ridiculous. You can't waste. And it was a moral argument. We got to a moral argument. I love a moral argument. You've wasted that money. You could have had £500 speakers. And so friend A says to friend B, that's a bit rich from a man driving a Porsche. You know, you could drive a mini, that's how long ago it was, you could drive a mini metro, right? And so they're having at it. The moral argument. I can give you a perfectly reasonable explanation why I have all the screwdrivers and all the things I've got, but I see through your consumerism without any problem. We need to be careful. We need to be careful. And beware the righteous spending. You know, the righteous spending. Get one of those electric cars, good for the environment. The fact that it's shiny and new, of course, has nothing to do with it. It's just, you know, I'm just doing the best. Get the his and her Rolexes, give £10 to save the whale, right? We've all done it. Get a new one of these things, shift out the old one to somebody else. Now, the Gospels tell us about giving, okay? And we've been to Wesley, haven't we? And we've said goodbye to all those temptations. We've put them in their place. Yeah, we'll get round to you. We'll get round to you. But first I'm going to think about my giving. And the Gospels give three contexts. The widow puts in all she can, doesn't she, into the thing. We don't have a big treasury chest here, but you can give to the church. See Jacqueline for organising a standing order, or there's a box screwed by Ian Scale to the back if you want to give some cash. That's great. Or, you know, give here if you prefer that. Then there's personal giving. Jesus, as I say, never handled money, but he was given things. The woman at Simon the leper's house poured that expensive perfume over him. What a picture of extravagant giving. I went to a great missionary talk last century, funnily enough, and the missionary said, and I've never forgotten this, if you want to have treasure in heaven, give your money to somebody who's going there. Okay? Can I encourage you to find somebody you want, not me, obviously, yeah, no, not me, somebody you want to support, a Christian worker, or an activity, yeah? And we've got loads of these, we've got James and Virag, we've got Clive Cornish over in Ely, if you want to do it locally, we've got Pete and Jen in Rwanda, we've got Jonathan and Amanda in France, we've got Paul and Alison Young in Meisting, loads of opportunities for you to give regularly. I mustn't forget Jimmy and Gina, Work Among Muslims in London. How needed is that? Start small, like all investments. I'm not saying that you got about £25,000. No. Well, if you want to, praise the Lord. But why not give them £5 a month? Because if you're that sort of person, knowing that there will be £5 every month, and then you can forget about it, right? Get on with your life while you're giving. That's great. If you want to chat about what opportunities there might be, come and see me afterwards. Let's close with a text that sums, it's scary how close to Jesus this is. This is Paul writing to Timothy. Command those who are rich. Hands up those who are rich. Command those who are rich. Not tell, not suggest, not advise. Command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant, nor to put their hope in the wealth, which is so uncertain, as we've seen, but to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. All that good stuff we've got has come from God. Command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, and to be generous and willing to share. In this way, they will lay up treasure for themselves as a firm foundation for the coming age, so they may take hold of the life that is truly life.